Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, dear listener, and welcome to another episode of Everyone is Hot, the podcast that talks about your favorite stealth sex symbols and the film or TV show that turned you on to them. I'm Michael Stevens.
And I'm Shelley Brooks. And Michael, we have a very exciting return guest today, do we not?
We have a super cool guest, Double Threat producer and co-founder of Forever Dog Podcast, Brett Baum, everyone.
Hey! Yay! So glad to be back with you. This is so exciting.
And the kids are happy to have you back, Brett.
Oh my gosh. Thank you, kids. It's been too long, children.
Now, Brett, we did things a little bit differently for this episode. Normally, we have our guest choose a crush to bring to us and choose a movie that we're going to talk about. This time, I had someone that I had been itching to talk about and a movie that I really wanted to focus on, and I thought that you would be the perfect person to discuss it with. Would you like to tell us who today's stealth sex symbol is and which movie we're going to talk about?
Absolutely. Today's stealth sex symbol is the one and only Stacy Keach. Ooh. And we are going to be talking about John Huston's Fat City from 1972.
Yes,
so I am thrilled that you reached out to me about this. It was like telekinesis. You know, it was like a unspoken crush across the country. And as soon as I heard, I was like, oh, yeah, he is hot. And that movie is great. Let's do this.
It is. I'm imagining the telephone wire. This is by email, not by telephone, but the telephone wire like buzzing, buzzing, buzzing across from New York to L.A.
The telegram station was just like going nuts. Yes. It was just telegram machines exploding. Yes. Down at the corner store.
Yeah, no, I have been wanting to do this one for a very long time, and it seemed like a good opportunity because it seems like Fat City has been getting a bit of a resurgence due to being on the Criterion Channel.
Yes.
In fact, right before I got on, I saw a tweet about Fat City that I will not quote the tweet right now because it does give away these almost like M. Night Shyamalan-esque ending surprise that I'm sure we will discuss later on that is quite shocking. It is not due to the plot. It is due to my being 31 years old.
Yes, it is. It's okay. I screamed when I found the big twist.
But we will get to that soon. In the meantime, Michael, if someone has not seen John Huston's Fat City, could you tell them what the movie is about?
Ah, absolutely. So on the down and out margins of Stockton, California, washed up alcoholic boxer Billy Tully finds himself in limbo between retirement and his youthful prime. Sparring with budding 18-year-old fighter Ernie inspires Tully to get back into the ring. But as the young man's career ascends, Tully finds himself battling against his inner demons and his quest to make a comeback.
The listener might note that this is a slightly superior synopsis to our
That was pretty damn good.
That's from the Criterion Channel, not from IMDb.
Oh, okay.
That was written by a professional, unlike many of the synopses that we use on this show.
Like, so,
a round of applause for Criterion, you guys. It is. Well, before we get into the main discussion, you know that we like to get a little slick, a little warm, and we like to do that with the sexy trivia game. Michael, what is the sexy trivia game?
Oh, well, the sexy trivia game is just a moment in time to get the listeners real slick for some movie chatting with some movie trivia. I'll get us started. Reportedly, after the showing of this movie, champion boxer Muhammad Ali apparently said to the film's director, John Huston, Houston. Man, that's for real. That's me talking up there. Oof. Now yes, I called it when I saw it. That was a really good Muhammad Ali impression. Great young man. Great.
Excellent young man. Excellent. Now, Brett, would you like to give us number B?
Oh, I'd love to. John Huston initially wanted Marlon Brando to play the role of Tully. When Brando informed Huston repeatedly that he needed some more time to think about it, Huston finally came to the conclusion that the star wasn't really interested and looked out for another actor until he finally cast the then relatively unknown Stacy Keach.
Ooh. Ooh, Stacy, we're so glad he found you. Now to finish us off, here's number C. According to Stacy Keach, Sixto Rodriguez knocked him out during their fight scene. And that shot appears in the film. And that's the sexy trivia game. I always wonder what the sort of like algebra that goes into figuring out if you really put in the shot of someone getting fucked up on your movie set. it's inevitably going to look better than the fake ones. But...
Yeah, I was always shocked that they kept that original footage in the Twilight Zone movie. And sorry.
It's like, well, the crow geez, was guys. Really bold for using. I suppose the answer is if the actor doesn't die, it's fair game.
Yes. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So that said, I was actually because you know the sort of rabbit holes you go down when you're supposed to be at work. I was reading about stunt performers who got injured during the filming of movies, and there was some recent movie, I can't remember which one it was, where the stunt performer did die, and they did use that shot in the movie.
No
the
fucking way. Film.
God.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know,
oh my God.
It's all for art. Well, so, on a lighter note, To go from death to this bleak, bleak movie, you said it was a bit of a kismet that we reached out to you about talking about this movie. So, Brett, what's your background with Fat City?
You know, I was trying to retrace this. I think I probably saw it for the first time, like, you know, in college when I was like kind of, you know, finding good movies and kind of just like devouring them as quickly as I could. And I think I found out about this movie because it's featured in that documentary Visions of Light, like the cinematography documentary. There's a lot of focus on is it Gordon Willis's like all of the like it's kind of like the key example of like low light cinematography in this documentary. And I remember all the shots they were showing of like the second time that Stacy Keach comes in the bar. And it's like so dark inside, and it's only like backlit from the windows. And they were talking about how this sort of broke all the rules of cinematography at the time. And I was just, you know, it's one of those documentaries where you're just like writing down every movie as they're mentioning it. But that one's really stuck out, and so I went and watched it. And I didn't know John Huston had directed it, so that was like kind of another thing that drew me to it. And yeah, I just loved it. I mean, I mean, you know, in general, any movie that kind of gets outside the major cities and the coasts and the bubbles is always of interest to me. And so this one, I think, immediately was drawn to and then was yeah, I was so excited to revisit it now, like, you know, recently, because I loved it all the more. I think it's just a fantastic movie, and Stacey Keach and really everybody top to bottom is just amazing in this movie.
Yeah, and it's interesting you're talking about getting out of the sort of like LA, New York bubbles. Like, I don't know very much about the West Coast. I haven't really spent time out there, but so it is so fascinating to see a part of California that's not just the LA that you see over and over and over again in movies. To see, I mean, Stockton, like, I know so little about, I mean, it, but, you know, my only connection to these kinds of California stories are, you know, reading like, oh my God, why am I blanking on the name of Mice and Men?
Like Steinbeck. Yeah.
But yeah, that's my only real connection to this kind of California story. And like, it's nice to see, I think it, part and parcel with seeing these locales that aren't the typical Hollywood locales is that it's populated by actors who aren't your typical Hollywood actors. Like, everyone has such a unique look. I mean, first and foremost, Stacey Keach. What a sort of like magnificent looking man, like the receding hairline, the, you know, the hair lip, the, mm-hmm. he's got that like fit body, but it's not like, an aesthetically fit body. It's a fit body from like work. It's really exciting to see him, see his face on screen.
Yeah. It's interesting to hear about the Marlon Brando connection, that Brando was the original, because Stacey Keach really does feel there's things about him physically that feel Brando-esque, like the body type and things. But it's such a, I think to me, he is such a better fit for the world of this movie than Marlon Brando. Yeah. So it's kind of like a, I don't know, it's almost like if Marlon Brando was like a real person, what he would look like or something. Yeah. You know, it's like, if Marlon Brando was this character, he would be Stacey Keach. And so I think, to me, the casting is, I think they lucked out there. I think it was, you get a, and even though like Stacey Keach, I was kind of surprised if I was looking into, I didn't really know much about his background. I was kind of surprised to find that he's like, I mean, he is like an actor with a capital A. I mean, Shakespearean, Yale drama school.
Actor.
I know. I was like, you could have fooled me. I thought it was maybe like a Harrison Ford situation with this. He was like somebody's carpenter and they just like put him in the movie. There's a method there, you know, as sort of minimalist as and natural as the performance is. There's definitely a method going on behind the scenes there.
The Brando thing is fascinating because I don't know. I have to assume that Houston meant to shoot it maybe a few years earlier, because 72 is also the year The Godfather came out. And like, obviously they aged Brando up for that. But as I alluded to, the scare line that comes at the end of the movie, which is that Stacey Keach's character says that he is 29. And if you've not watched this movie, listener, this will, I'm sorry that I spoiled it for you, because it is honestly one of the most devastating.
It's a spoiler. It is a big spoiler.
That's a rough 29. With all due respect to the gorgeous Stacey Keach, that is a rough 29.
Yeah, and so even for, you know, Brando, as beautiful as he was, that would have been a real stretch in 72 to 29-year-old Brando. But yeah, but I mean, I think that is the thing. It's like, even though he does have this sort of very actory with a capital A pedigree, I think that the look is something that helps him feel more real, because he doesn't seem coiffed. He doesn't seem like perfected. He looks like he's lived a life in a rough one. And so, Michael, this was your first time seeing the movie, right?
Oh my God. So I saw this with very little context outside of sometimes my grandma would say like things like, I was like, oh, we're going to Fat City. And you know, that's a phrase. It's like, oh, you know, we're going to the good place. Things are going to get good. And so I went in with that being my only context, and pleasantly surprised that this is my favorite kind of movie, a movie about broken people in a broken place with broken dreams. I talk a lot about how much I love the Rocky movies, but like watching this was so grounding. when it comes to that whole genre, boxing movies and then sports movies, which usually, you know, are there to make you feel good, but this one,
this the feels team like scored the goal at the end of this one.
This feels like kind of the Raging Bull lineage. Like, we're getting closer to Raging Bull here with like the way boxing is depicted as just like just empty violence, kind of like that. Yeah. That, like, when we finally see Stacy Keach in his big boxing match, which he, like, you know, spoiler alert, kind of like insanely wins. Like, it's like, no, I love it. It's like the emptiest victory you've ever witnessed in a sports movie. Yeah. Where he's confused. He thought he got knocked out. And it's kind of one of the best scenes I've ever seen in a sports movie, because, like, he wins. The loser, who was, like, I guess favored, just packs up and like that shot of him, like, coming into town and leaving town is such a brilliant move, I think. Yeah. And just like that, he's just like, just his job. He's just there for the job. And then and there's, like, no glory either way. It's just like, yeah. So I feel like, you know, the way it's shot, we're getting I have to imagine, Scorsese watched this for Raging Bull, because it feels like that kind of boxing violence, well, not the sort of
funny for people who are not sports people like myself and Michael. We've ended up talking about boxing movies a lot on this podcast. So I definitely, like, as I was watching this again for this podcast, was thinking about that, like, boxing lineage. Because, for example, in a recent episode, we talked to Holly Roshan, and she talked about her love for the movie Golden Boy. This definitely has echoes of that a little bit. And we talked in a previous episode about our favorite fight scenes, about Rocco and his brothers, which Scorsese has explicitly talked about, you know, referencing for. I think that it does seem that, like, a through line in boxing movies that I think really resonates with me as a sports movie is that aspect of it, that it is just a job, and that oftentimes it's these people in these kind of dire financial straits that have to get, like, the shit kicked out of them repeatedly. Yep. Like, it, like, literalizes this process of, like, what it's like to be broke. There's, like, it's not just, like, you're, you know, poetically, you're getting, like, the shit kicked out of you by the world. You're literally getting, like, your head bashed in by this guy just to make, I mean, the ending of this, when he wins that fight, is so devastating, in part because he gets out of the ring and then finds out he's been, like, shorted on his money because he's like, owed his manager.
Yep.
So it's like, he can't fucking win. Like, he wins and he still loses.
But yeah, presented, like, boxing is really presented as, like, just like the military or the fields. It's like, it's like this, like, this track that poor people get on just for, like, other, and they're, like, sort of promised, like, the potential for glory and fame and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's ultimately just violent entertainment for the rest of the town that, you know, and so, yeah, it's the way boxing is depicted in this movie is so interesting and haunting.
Yeah, and then it's like, has that parallel with them working in the fields. And it's like, in both of them, their bodies are treated as so disposable. Like, they're just there to make some money for somebody else, whether it's their manager or, like, the farm owner. They're going to be, like, out in the brutal sun or getting, like, punched in the face. And it's going to have its toll on them. But what does that matter to the guy who's making the money, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oof. It's rough. Sorry, Michael, what were you going to say?
No. I this is all taking me back to a conversation I had with my grandfather when I was like, I want to be a boxer. And he was like, you do not. You cannot want this.
I wonder about, like, I'm sure so many kids, you know, Brett, you and I both grew up in the South, and, you know, football is so big here. I have to wonder what kinds of conversations, the more we learn about the impact of football, like, parents are having with their kids who, like, want to grow up to be a football player. And it's like,
I was gonna say, I think, and I wonder if this, I couldn't find a whole lot about, like, Stacy Keach's, like, process for this, but I do wonder, knowing he's, like, this trained actor, I started to read everything as, like, choices and like really conscious decisions he was making, and so there's something stylistically he does where he's constantly seems to be almost losing his train of thought, or he's kind of like sort of loopy all the time. And I mean, I initially was reading that as, like, that he's that, you know, 'cause he drinks so much, but then I have to wonder if he's, like, early stage CTE as well. And if that was a conscious or just unconscious decision, but he really seems like someone who is, like, you know, who is, like, 5-10 years away from, like, serious brain, you know, injury or trouble.
There is something so interesting, like, considering the sort of, like, pedigree that he comes from, that he, like, captures this thing so specifically, because I haven't seen him in that much, honestly. And prior to seeing Fat City, what I primarily knew him from was the film adaptation of The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. And he plays a very similar character in that. He's this like kind of alcoholic drifter who, you know, just happens to cross paths with Alan Arkin's character. And, you know, he's got the same sort of cadence, like the line that I always hear him saying is like when he wakes up from his drunken stupor in Alan Arkin's room and realizes he's deaf and he goes, "A dummy? Well, I never met a dummy before." It's like this weird sort of like, it's like regional, but also kind of he's a little out of it. Like it almost looks like he's got like cartoon like birds. But yeah, so I wonder where that sort of like almost like musicality of his phrasing comes from, because it's so sort of specific and does seem to have this kind of like addled quality to it a lot of times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, because I was reading, he was born in Savannah, so he's from he's from Georgia, but then and like to a family of actors. I mean, it's such a it's like honestly not the backstory I was expecting, but I love it. And then from there, like like we said, Yale Drama School, Shakespeare. So I think he's like. Yeah, I really, I would be so curious to hear him talk about like the, I mean, because he was doing, he was up until, I guess Heart is a Lonely Hunter was before Fat City.
Yeah,
maybe,
that was like late 60s.
But up until then, he's just doing Shakespeare, like, you know, like regional repertory kind of Shakespeare. So I would like, this transition into film and then specifically these sort of, like slightly out of it. But with also kind of a poetic sensibility, these sort of characters, these sort of like doomed masculinity characters, like I would love to hear more about that transition, but it's because he kind of hides, he really hides the Shakespeare pedigree. I didn't get a sense of like, you know, John Gielgud stepping in and trying to be like, what does it mean to be in Stockton and to be a boxer?
Oh, to labor in the fields with one's hands.
You really don't get that at all. And it's kind of remarkable because, like I said, you could have surprised me. He could have been somebody that was like, you know, found, you know, locally and I would have believed it. But he just really, he really gives such a believable, naturalistic performance in this.
I do have a feeling, though, that probably he and John Huston have this similar thing of the sort of high and low combined in them as people and as artists. Because, I mean, something I oftentimes go back and read like the Stacey Keach Wikipedia because it's I find it very amusing. But one of the things in his personal life section is that he was in jail in the UK for a while because he like got caught with cocaine, and then he became so Catholic there that he like eventually met the Pope. So it's like obviously my man was like living hard.
Right.
And, like,
what a 180. Oh my God.
Yeah. And it's like in John Huston, I mean, you know, he is this great artist and, you know, he clearly has this sort of like high-minded element to him. You know, he's making adaptations of like The Dead, you know, later in his career, but he also was a fucking maniac. He was like a fucking fuck machine. He's having sex with everyone and a raging alcoholic. I mean, he literally killed someone in like a drunk driving hit and run, and he shot another woman through his windshield in a drunk driving accident. And, you know, and he himself was an amateur boxer, like, so I have a feeling there was a sort of kinship there in these men with these. But, you know, at the same time, Huston was often described as being like the most poetic man in Hollywood who had this grace about him. So I think that they both have that sort of weird, like, twin thing within them of both the poet and the dissolute, you know?
Yeah, I believe that. I always think of Huston in Chinatown as like, I was like, that's probably who he was. That's like that, like that was like, yeah, that is just a maniac with like a poetic sensibility. It seemed like pretty good typecasting for him. But I do love this late period of Huston, like you said, with The Dead. And then and even when it's a little bit off, like he did a version of Wise Blood that I think is hit or miss, but is like fascinating. Under the Volcano, like he did like some real wild literary adaptations like in his later career that I think are all like worth watching, you know, for better
and
or worse.
That's Finian under the Volcano, right?
I'm sorry?
That's Albert Finney.
Albert Finney. And then Wise Blood. Brad Dourif in Wise Blood.
But Finney is interesting to me because it seems like Huston did tend to like collect these kind of, these sort of tough guys but also have a sort of grace to them, but are also like hardcore alcoholics and just kind of self-destructive. Like, you know, I think about him and the famous stories about him and Bogey on The African Queen, how everyone got like dysentery and they were the only two that were fine because they never drank water. They just like drank whiskey the entire time. They were just drunk the entire time, so they didn't have a chance to. But yes, yeah, so I wonder if like, yeah, Stacey Keach has that same kind of pull that some of the like the Bogarts and the Albert Finneys maybe had for John Huston.
Yeah, I feel like he was having trouble with Brando like everyone was at this time. And he probably went out and got drinks with Stacey Keach and was like, we'll just use this guy. This yeah. works. This works. Pay him a quarter of what we had to pay Brando. So it right. all, this is great, actually.
I mean, what a deal.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I mean, something that you brought up in our like email exchange is that you also wanted to focus a bit on Susan Tyrell in this movie, who is remarkable.
And unbelievable. I mean,
yeah. So tell me a little bit about like, is have you seen her in many other things? And like, what was your first impression when you saw her in this movie?
I need to do a Susan Tyrell deep dive because I've yeah. certainly, you know, was aware of her. I know from like, you know, she's in Crybaby, you know, John Waters, right. like she's like Andy Warhol adjacent. I mean, she has such a fascinating like career. I don't have a lot of firsthand experience with watching her and stuff, but now I want to go back and watch everything because from the first second she steps into this movie, I mean, with all due respect and look and props to Stacey Keach for like giving her like, you know, knowing when she is like knowing when it's her scene and letting her have the scene.
Yeah.
Because like the first time, you know, she comes in, she just owns the screen. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, you can't take your eyes off her. Mm-hmm. It is such an incredible, like, you know, there's like it's like on the page it's just like, you know, this like, you know, sad drunk lady, but like she yeah. layers in so much like self-pity and then mad at you for playing into the self-pity and like, don't yeah. you dare pity me, and then like, and then suddenly she is like kind of like happy and celebratory, and like it is such like the swings, and each wild swing is believable though, and it's mm-hmm. like it is just a tornado of like a performance, and it is like so it's just so compelling, and now I want to go watch her in everything she's ever done.
Yeah
that ability to swing back and forth between the moods and things is so fascinating, because I mean she's so attractive, and so you can like understand why he would go home with her, because she can be so sexy, but it's like then in the next minute she'll be so pathetic and like it'll be like, oh god. But and I think that having that character is really interesting for the Stacey Keach character, because before you got on, Michael and I were talking about the fact that a guy who looks like him, like that kind of actor, is probably gonna mostly play kind of scumbags and, you know, assholes, and he's, you know, a fuck up in this movie, but he seems to be fundamentally pretty decent.
Yeah.
And even when she's like at her worst, you're like, why are you all so mean to me and I yeah. can't <That's> so good. That he's still like, he doesn't just like, you know, kick her to the curb. Though granted yeah. he also needs to stay in her apartment, so
yeah
right.
What did you think, Michael?
Oh my god, that scene at the bar, I guess it's their second scene together. It she's like, oh, my man's in prison or whatever, and like,
girl,
like I think it just everything clicked for me. It's like the madness, the red hair, the yellow dress that comes back a lot, because, you know, she's, you know, probably don't got that many dresses. I don't know. And her damp face for most of the movie. I thought she was absolutely incredible. Big, like scary clown energy.
Like those little barrettes that are always like hanging loosely, they're about to like fall out of her hair. There's yeah. like there's like the every aspect of like the costume and everything is just perfect. I mean, the character is so fully realized.
Yeah, I've been watching it on, I had watched it on a laptop screen, and when she was on, I was like, I need to experience this on the biggest screen possible, because she's really like unreal.
Yeah. She has a line to Stacey Keach, the second scene in the bar, where she goes, you're the only son of a bitch worth shit in this place. Which is like, I was like, if Susan Tyrell ever said that to me, I would like, that would be on my tombstone. I might just have to retire and move into the woods, because it doesn't get better. It does not get better in human civilization than Susan Tyrell telling you, you're the only son of a bitch worth shit in this place.
Oh, it's so good. Oh my gosh. And just the two of them, like, looking so rough and so, like, sad. That, so then young Jeff Bridges playing this, like, 18-year-old up-and-coming guy, he's so bright and hopeful in those early scenes. To see him slowly get ground down throughout the movie is, oh, it's rough. It's rough to watch.
It's rough. And I have a confession to make about Jeff, or young Jeff Bridges, which is, and I don't mean this in any way. I would never say anything like this about his physical appearance, is actually the way he looks. I'm talking about his, like, physicality as a young actor is repulsive to me. It's this movie. There's a Bob Rafelson movie called Stay Hungry that's really bizarre that he kind of plays a slightly similar character in. And there's something about, he just gives me, he can't hide. He just has, like, rich kid vibes to me, and he can't hide it. And it, there's like, there's just this bouncy, like, over eager, bouncy, like, I can do no wrong. Like, of course I was cast in this movie kind of vibe to him. And I just, like, and I can't, I know he is, like, a legend, and we all love Jeff Bridges, I guess. And, like, but, like, the young Jeff Bridges for me, I'm just like, anybody else in this role. But that's just, I don't know what it is. Something about young Jeff Bridges rubs me the wrong way.
That's so funny.
You're absolutely correct.
Yeah. The Last Picture Show, I do not care for him in that movie, but I really like how that affect works in this movie, because as a point of contrast with Stacey Keach, like, their physicality, like, there's, like, a sort of, like, looseness, I guess, to Jeff Bridges or something, like, that he feels so, it's like the John Mulaney joke where he's like, I'm open like a rag doll. Like, that's kind of how he feels, because it's like, what does he have to worry about?
Yeah, and not Stacey, a care in the world.
So sort of, like, tightly in, because, like, he feels like he knows, like, something's going to fall apart at any minute, you know?
Like, yeah, that's a great point, that it does work better, because that other movie, Stay Hungry, he actually plays like a rich, like, kid, like, inheriting a bunch of money, so it's a little more like you know, A to B, but, like, I think you're right, this movie creates a context where it kind of works better. And, like, that first scene, because you think he's, all the managers are telling him he's great, he's the next big thing, he's going to be this big boxer, and that first match he gets in is shot so interestingly, where you, like, you see him at the same time the manager does, when it's like a flurry of punches, you don't know what's happening, and he turns around and his face is just covered in blood, and he looks like he just got hit by a car, he's so confused. And the manager is seeing it for the first time that we are, and the manager is, like, shocked, and I'm like, if the boxing manager is shocked by what he's seeing, I guess I'm should be, you know, and rightfully shocked as well. And everybody is just like, oh, I guess we were wrong about this guy. It's kind of like the consensus everyone comes to at the same time. So he takes his lumps a little bit more, and I think that makes that does make his whole vibe kind of work better. But yeah, I don't know. Young Jeff Bridges is a rough pill to swallow for me.
And that, like, when he first gets his face fucked up, I mean, that's such a great turning point for him, I think. And I think that that's when you start to see some more interesting shading to him as an actor. Because afterwards, they've got that exchange with the manager where he's like, kid, I got my nose broken. Look at this. You'd never guess it, would you? And he's like, yeah, you would.
Yeah.
His whole act is, like, completely shifted by that point. Because he suddenly realizes, like, oh, this fucking sucks, and now I've signed up to do this. What the fuck am I doing? Oh, man. Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, he is maybe the least depressing of the characters in terms of, like, how their lives are going, and yet his is still so shitty. It's like, he gets stuck in this, like, boxing world. He knocks up this girl. He doesn't really want to marry her, but he does it because he's, like, a decent guy. It's so interesting in this movie that it just seems like they are all, like, stuck. There's no possible, like, route of escape for them, you know?
Yeah, like, the best bet in this world, I guess, is Jeff Bridges, which is just to kind of, like, sell out and be basic is kind of, like, the route he takes, you know, which is, like, I guess you get stability and he has a family to support and all that. But, like, you know, all of the romanticism of his life is gone at that point. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's driving out of town to do boxing matches, driving back home, you know, you know, he's not going to go to the bar with Stacey Keach. They're just going to grab coffee. You know, that's kind of the best you can hope for is just sort of middle of the road.
Yeah. It's like none of these characters ever get a sort of moment of glory. Cause even when Jeff Bridges and Stacey Keach first meet in the beginning, you know, he says to Stacey Keach, like, oh, yeah, I remember seeing you fight. I saw you fight so-and-so or whatever. And Stacey Keach goes, did I win? He goes, no. Like, he doesn't even get to live in his past glory. It's like even his the supposed glory, he was still losing. There's just no win there. So, Brett, like, of movies of this era, like, what are some other performances that you think have this same kind of appeal that, like, Stacey Keach has? This, because he's got something very specific, and I think very specific to the era.
Yeah, I love this type of performance. I loved a good, I said before, kind of like doomed masculinity, like a very like a masculinity that is simultaneously like traditional, but very, very wounded and kind of tragic at the same time. I compare, I mean, I think of, yeah, I guess like Gene Hackman performances of this era, like Night Moves kind of comes to mind. And then sort of outside of this era, you know, he reminds me a lot of like a, Robert Mitchum or a Ray Liotta. I guess Ray Liotta is a little more kind of manic and twitchy here, but the, but they kind of to me like emote the same thing, which is that like that sort of, you know, tragic masculinity, like, you know, a masculinity that kind of wants to be better than itself, but is sort of trapped by this or by that, and then it's just sort of a slow, tragic descent. And you're hoping for, you know, the best is like maybe one little glimpse of glory at some point. But otherwise, it's going to be kind of, you know, a downward slide from start to finish. I particularly was like when Ray Liotta died, it like hit me really hard, like really more than kind of a lot of the other actor deaths we've had, because I feel like he was on such he had found such a great like late career niche of really digging into that specific style of acting of this sort of that just wounded kind of tragic masculinity. Like he really what's the one Brad Pitt was the hitman Killing Him Softly. Which is for me kind of up or down movie, but he is fantastic in it. And also like that The Sopranos movie, which was not great. He's really, really good in it, playing two roles, which is crazy. So I felt like he had really found something there, and would have loved to get a couple more of those performances. But I was reminded kind of of a Ray Liotta, Robert Mitchum, maybe Gene Hackman kind of vibe. Yeah. What about you guys? Does this feel like reminiscent of anything else?
I actually this is going to sound like an insult, but I actually mean this as a compliment towards Stacey Keach. He is not a star. Like he's a great actor. He's not a movie star. And I think this movie works in a way that it wouldn't work with Brando because he's not a star. Similarly to how I think Sorcerer works with Roy Scheider in a way that it wouldn't have worked if it had been, what's his name? Bullitt, who was supposed to be in it.
Steve McQueen. Yeah.
McQueen is supposed to be in Sorcerer. I don't think that movie works if you've got a big star like that. I think you need someone who feels like a person. So, I mean, he's definitely in that sort of like Roy Scheider camp for me, where they are brilliant actors, but they can absorb themselves into the movie rather than dominating the movie, you know?
That's a great call. Yeah. Because all the people I mentioned have a little extra little big screen A-list kind of vibe. But you're right. You really, Stacey Keach has more of a character actor vibe. He's really kind of in between almost. He's sort of like stuck right in between. But you're right, not quite. There's just whatever that thing is. And look, God bless him for it, because it gives us, I think, you know, that's what gives us this performance and gives us this movie, is it's not someone who sort of, there's no one who transcends the movie in this movie. Mm-hmm. Everyone is like in the world of the movie.
And that in-between thing is a good point, because I do think he is like incredibly charismatic. And I think that that's part of like his appeal in this role, is that like he's sexy and he's funny and he's nice and he's charismatic. And there are like lots of things going for him. He just can't stop being a fuck up. But he's not so charismatic that like it feels like he is the movie. Mm-hmm. He's part of the movie, you know? Yeah. What do you think, Michael?
This made me think of, I had to write down my thoughts. This made me think of Michael Shannon Frankie and Johnny. So he did like a production a couple years back that he was incredible in. And he plays an ex-con who's recently, you know, just got out of prison, and he got into a one night
one night stand, and he's trying to make it work with this girl who like doesn't really give a shit about him. But it's like an early 80s comedy drama, and yeah, it just captures a kind of like casual disappointment that's not like overdoing it. And then the other performance that I thought of was Robert Duvall in Tender Mercies, which is another movie about a broken man trying to start over. I love both of these, especially Tender Mercies. Yeah, I'm probably going to rewatch that one after this to really.
those are great comparisons.
Yeah, I would even say Robert Duvall a little bit in Godfather, I think, because that sort of like utility kind of performance that he has in that, you know, like he's so moving in it, but he doesn't overtake the picture or try to overtake the picture in the way that like a Pacino or a Khan does. Like he's so much more understated in a way that I find very moving.
Right.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's kind of, I think, my favorite like category of actor, those like, they've got enough charisma that they can star in a movie, but they're not necessarily movie stars. Like, I think that like Brad Dourif is another one of those that like, those are always a little bit more interesting to me, I think, than the like the big personalities. But yeah, I think Susan Tyrell probably is also in kind of in that world.
That's and it's so interesting to compare, you know, to think of this in its time period, because we don't really like talk about John Huston in the context of New Hollywood, but I feel like he was... I feel like he should be talked about. I mean, I understand that he was, you know, did the Maltese Falcon and whatever else and was like, and, you know, had this like golden age Hollywood career. But like, he's doing the same thing that all those other new Hollywood directors are doing here. And in terms of like, you know, the like, you know, more kind of realistic storytelling, character driven approach to like the whole, you know, to movies. So I like, yeah, I feel like late career Huston deserves to be mentioned with, you know, your... whoever, Bogdanovich and Scorsese and Coppola and all those guys.
I think like technically I think if you didn't know that it was directed by John Huston, you would never guess that this was like an old man's project or someone from like a different era. I think that where that kind of comes through is in that sort of like fatalism of it. Like it does feel like someone whose life is kind of winding down, especially a guy who like easily could have ended up having a life like these people, the number of times he completely like fucks shit up. And he just, by the grace of God and grace of money and grace of being a, you know, a famous man in Hollywood, you know, somehow continued to have a pretty cush life. But, you know, he easily could have and probably deserved to have had a bit more consequence to some of the stuff that he did.
Yeah,
it's funny. I sometimes will, you know, reading like Hollywood trivia on, you know, various places online, will like try to make a lot of these like old Hollywood stories sound like so cute and fun and crazy. Like these people were nuts. And then it's like these people were nuts, but not in like a cute way. Like most of them were like psychopaths.
I recently read this. It was like a biography of Oliver Reed, Richard Burton, Richard Harris, and Peter O'Toole, and it's called like Hellraisers or something. And this the biographer started out, he was like he was trying to make these guys seem like the coolest guys on the face of the earth, and then you can just see him like lose confidence in himself as he's writing, because he's like he's telling about their horrible childhoods and their like alcoholic marriages and all this stuff, and you like the language just slowly shifts, and you can see this guy just being like, this isn't as cool as I thought it was, like these guys are disasters. So depressing.
Oh my God. Like I did learn relatively recently, I didn't know that like Richard Burton like paralyzed his brother when they got into like a drunken brawl, and it was like, oh my God, like we all were like, oh my God, the romance of Burton and Taylor, and it's like, I don't know, it's
a maniacs. No, the same. I also reread Easy Rider's Raging Bulls recently, and like, and oh my God, like, you know, I mean, all of them, but I was like, Dennis Hopper was like almost Charles Manson. Like literally one thing goes differently and Hopper is 100% Charles Manson.
Oh my
like,
God.
It is like not like it's not just like, they got drunk and stayed out too late. These guys were violent, like maniacs. And it is like shocking to read some of these stories.
Yeah. Oh, it's crazy. I mean, I remember getting into like Herzog's movies when I was a kid, and then finally, you know, learning, you know, a bit more about behind the scenes, like, you know, Kinski and abusing his daughter, and like, yep. That man was genuinely like not just like a, you know, someone who could get away with doing bad things because he was famous. He was genuinely like insane. Like that was insane. A mentally unwell man. Like,
yeah, he went like he do you know about this Nosferatu in Venice movie that Kinski made where he like, no. So he was in Herzog's Nosferatu and then he decided that he wanted to make a sequel called Nosferatu in Venice just because he wanted to take a vacation to Venice and needed a reason to do so and somebody else to pay for it. And Herzog was like, I don't want to do that. That sounds bad. And so Kinski like on his own, like got funding and got a film crew to Venice and made a movie called Nosferatu in Venice, which is almost impossible to find, which is like, and he didn't, but he also refused to get in the Nosferatu makeup. So it's just Kinski like running around Venice and being like, I'm Nosferatu, ooh, spooky, I'm Nosferatu.
And like, what?
And then it is like, I know, it's absolutely crazy. But then like, this is the dark part, of course, because like with every Kinski story, you're like, ah, that's like funny, crazy. And then, yeah. And then you find out that he was like abusing the actress on set. And then Jesus. She has like all these issues come out of it. And like, was, you know, lawsuits and this and that. And like,
oh
and
God.
Like, and it's just like, man, these guys are like actual maniacs. Like they, like, it's yeah. like, it's like, you know, it's like, there's the like, part of the story that's like fun and crazy, and yeah. then there's like the part of the story that's like crazy and
yeah
there's and always how, both things going on,
yeah, and how like just normal it is, because I mean I don't think yeah. Wells did anything like too crazy, but like even just the casual way he'll talk about things in that book My Lunches with Orson, like towards yeah. the end there's a part that like people love to like screenshot that book and like tweet about it and stuff, like when he's like ragging on Woody Allen and stuff and just being, you know, witty and fun. He's got like a weird bit towards the end where he's talking about like a like 13-year-old actress that he was working with, and he's like, I couldn't sit around that one too long. I've got a little bit of that thing that your friend Roman's got. And then Henry Yaglom like quickly changes the subject.
Yeah.
He's like, so tell me about your other movie that you're working on, Orson. Oh, it's like, yikes.
Yikes.
Yeah. Hollywood. Beautiful.
Hollywood.
Beautiful place full Hooray. Of beautiful people.
Oof. Oh, motherfuckers. Well, wow.
On a lighter note, we like to, in this show, try to come up with a dream pairing with the movie that we're talking about. And this could be what you would like to watch on a double bill, a movie that you would recommend to someone who likes this movie, a movie that you think contrasts nicely. It's all up to your interpretation. Michael, would you like to start out with your pairing?
So my one and only pairing with this movie is Lenny Cook, the documentary by the Safdie brothers. It's about Lenny Cook, who is a Bushwick native. He was one of the top ranked basketball players. He expected to be included in the 2002 draft, but he went unselected. And LeBron James, Jesus, I don't watch sports. I was going to say Lamar Odom. it's like he doesn't play sports. But yeah, LeBron James pretty much has Lenny Cook's career for the most part. And the movie, the documentary kind of follows his life. And I watched it thinking it was going to be like a cautionary tale. But it's actually just middle of the road, similar to how I felt at the end of Fat City. It was just like, I guess that's life. And you move on and, you know, it can destroy, you can let it destroy you or you can, you know, persist. And that was one of the things I really liked about Fat City. And something I really, really love about this one. No one ever has seen it whenever I ask. Have either of you seen it?
Mm-mm.
I've really been wanting to watch it. That's a great call. I haven't been able to find it, but I really, really want to watch it.
Whenever it's on, it's usually on Criterion every once in a while, and I'll be like, hey, everybody watch this. But
and if I could, too, I know one of the Safdie's favorite movies, they always bring this up when they're asked for like top five, top 10 movies that would also work well here is Requiem for a Heavyweight, which is a little more of a spot on pairing. But yeah. Similar kind of like, sort of sad, tragic boxing movie. Anthony Quinn, Jackie Gleason came out in 1962. And actually has, I think Muhammad Ali is actually in it. In a small role. A little more spot on of a pairing, but would be good as well.
Ooh, this is a good one.
Well, speaking of, Brett, what would you pair with Fat City?
I guess Requiem for a Heavyweight was what I was thinking, but it's a little hat on a hat. Maybe like Wanda might be a good pairing. Ooh, with this kind of like, if you want to stay kind of, you know, off the grid, the struggles of people in the working class parts of the country. I haven't seen Wanda for a while, but that was the first thing that came to mind. The Barbara Loden movie.
Was that 71?
I'm seeing 1970. Yeah. So same time period, kind of coal country in Pennsylvania. Mm. I don't remember if it's actually shot in real time, but it feels like it's kind of in real time. Kind of a slice of life of a woman kind of living on the edges of this like coal town in Pennsylvania. But Barbara Loden, who was a great actor, wrote and directed it. It's really just a stunning, just very naturalistic slice of life kind of movie. There's a little bit of a like crime kind of goes on the lam with it's like a very like low stakes Bonnie and Clyde sort of thing goes on in it too, but sort of accidentally and with no forethought or anything. So I would say vibe wise, if you liked this, Barbara Loden's Wanda.
That's great.
Yeah, this one is 100% being watched this weekend.
It's so good.
Yeah, I don't know shit about Barbara Loden, so I...
This is very sexist, but she's often referred to as, like, the female Cassavetes. I think that could be easily switched around, but just as a reference point, that's kind of, like, her kind of vibe and, you know, aesthetic. Yeah.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, and mine are pairings that would be sort of like opposites of Fat City that have sort of some like superficial similarities, but things seem to just work out for the protagonists in these movies. These are underachievers, fuck-ups, people who are on a lot of substances, but somehow things seem to go pretty well for them. So one would be another Jeff Bridges classic, The Big Lebowski, another California movie. The dude I think is kind of a sort of inverted version of Stacy Keach's character in that he's also underemployed, often drunk, bit of a fuck up, but he's just kind of going along, man, you know?
Yeah.
And the other one is getting more into sort of like the class and like economic aspects of the movie. As Harmony Korine's The Beach Bum, which is one of my favorite movies.
I love The Beach Bum.
I fucking love The Beach Bum. And they are similar characters in many ways. Always drunk, just kind of constantly fucking up things for the people around them. But, you know, Stacy Keach's character is poor, so his life tends to get harder and harder and harder the more he does this. And Matthew McConaughey is very rich in The Beach Bum, so his life is awesome. So his wife dies, he gets sent to rehab, but he just keeps drinking and writing his poems and having a pretty grand time. So
it's the funniest part of that movie to me is just like the endless amount of money at his disposal. Yes. through the entire movie is so funny. And also RIP to Jimmy Buffett as well, who has a cameo in The Beach Bum. Those are amazing choices. Amazing.
Thank you very much. Well, we're getting low on time, but of course we always like to play a game before we go. We're keeping it classic this week with a fuck, marry, kill. The topic of this fuck, marry, kill is depressing boxing movies. So we will be deciding who we're going to fuck, who we're going to marry, and who we're going to kill between Tully, Stacy Keach's character in Fat City, Maggie, Hilary Swank's character in Million Dollar Baby, and Jake LaMotta, De Niro's character in Raging Bull.
My Michael, God.
Kick it off.
My God. What? Whoa. Okay. First off, I'm going to say, look, there are no right answers for this lineup. There are absolutely none. So everything that I say is going to be wrong. And everything that everyone says is going to be wrong. So I am going to I'm gonna kill Jake LaMotta. That's easy. I'm gonna kill Jake LaMotta. I would be very scared of him in a long term capacity, and I would be scared of him having sex. I am going to marry Maggie from Million Dollar Baby. That feels right. And then, yeah, I'm gonna fuck Stacey Keach. That's actually pretty easy. Let me take that back. That's actually pretty easy. It wasn't hard at all.
All right, Ben. How about you?
Well, if I remember Million Dollar Baby correctly, she wants to die. So yeah. So I feel like I have to kill Maggie as a mercy to her. So it feels like, be like, if she's like, please kill me, and I'm like, nope, wedding bells, baby, we're getting married. She'd be like, oh no. So I think I've got to kill Maggie. And oh boy, now this gets really tricky. I mean, my gut is definitely like, fuck Stacey Keach, but that means I gotta marry Jake LaMotta. It's insane.
Yeah.
I can't marry Jake LaMotta.
He has money for a while, Jake does, so.
Yeah. Oh, but he's.
Oh. Get that prenup.
That whole. I guess I just marry Jake LaMotta.
Oh, no.
Count the days until I can, you know, run off to Reno and get a divorce. I mean, I but then you're watching. You're watching over your shoulder the rest of your life. I don't know. This is bad. Maybe, you know what? Here's what I would do. I would marry Jake LaMotta. I'm forgetting the plot of Raging Bull, but I would actually fuck Joe Pesci, and then I would fingers crossed, hope Joe Pesci and Robert De Niro kill each other. You know, in the like the fuck my didn't fuck my wife scene. Does that kind of happen? Yeah, I'm kind of trying to remember the actual plot. But I would try to pit them against each other. Okay. They sort of. They both kill each other in some sort of violent duel, and then I'm left with all the LaMotta money, which hopefully there's enough left at that point. So that would be it's really we need to add some other letters to FMK, I think, but for this one. But
there should be, yeah.
FMK, what do you add for a by fucking Joe Pesci and LaMotta? I like it. Your logic is sound there, Brett.
Okay, thanks.
Mine is similar, but I'm going to have to flip a couple. Hmm. Unfortunately, I will have to kill Maggie. It is a mercy killing. I was, which I know that is problematic, and I know that that is ableist, and I know that this film is problematic for many reasons. That said, when I was a teenager and first saw that, I have forever since been haunted by when she bites off her own tongue to try to bleed to death.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, Maggie, I got you, Maggie. I'll be your Clint. But then I'm going to flip the fucking and the marrying. I'm going to fuck Jake LaMotta. I'm going to stipulate, though, this is young Jake LaMotta. Because I could put up with a lot for how De Niro looks in those early scenes. If you're that
good point. Good point.
I could put up with some personality flaws, I think. And then I'm going to marry Stacey Keach. Because listen, I think he's got a good heart. And I think I could turn him around.
You can change him. Yeah, you can.
If I can drive that guy out. Well, this was a very fun game of Fuck, Marry, Kill. And I think we all won. We are all winners here. Except for all the characters that we are fucking playing. None of them are winning, unfortunately.
Oh, I'm so glad we left Rocky out of this.
Yes. Rocky's too pure. We can't. I wouldn't call Adrian like that. Come on.
Yeah.
Well, Brett, this was so, so fun.
This was
great.
Thank
you for coming back.
And thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, of course. Do you have anything you want to promote, and like, where can people follow you on social media?
Yeah, sure. You can follow me on social at BREYYYATTT. And you can, I would love it if you checked out some podcasts on the Forever Dog Podcast Network. We've got a Double Threat with Tom Sharpling and Julie Klausner. We've got The Best Show, Tom Sharpling's long running comedy podcast, Office Hours Live with Tim Heidecker. So a lot of fun stuff on there for comedy fans. I am doing a monthly movie watch along on the Double Threat Patreon. I don't expect, if you're new to the show, I don't expect you to shill out $10 a month to get behind the paywall right away. But listen to Double Threat. If you like what you're hearing, there's a lot more stuff on the Double Threat Patreon. That's a lot of fun. But thank you so much for having me. This was a blast.
Amazing. And Michael, where can people follow us, and what should the listeners do?
Y'all can follow us on all socials at Everyone Is Hot Pod. That's every number one is hot pod. And remember to stay horny.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's JUVEDERM.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's JUVEDERM.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.